We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back to On Air. Happy Wednesday to you all, wherever you're listening around the world, whether it's on Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, Dan.
Hello, guys. If you're on YouTube, obviously by now you can tell there is no video this week. We're sorry about that, but there are some tech issues going on, so you'll have to just enjoy our voices today. And both Alex and I are freshly back from respective trips. Alex, how was yours?
Mine was good, partly because I was absolutely alone in first class on the A380, which was a complete dream. Because, of course, flying first class on any A380 is a dream. But being alone in first on QR's 380 was exceptional, not least because of those small extras that you can't do had there been someone else in the cabin. So primarily me being able to tell them, okay, you can switch the lights off now. Okay, I think I have the mood lighting on 25%. Let's go for sunset meets purple shades of whatever. 50 shades of purple.
Sunset meets Riyadh Air. You are like, can we turn this plane into Riyadh Air real quick?
Listen, most airlines go for purple and pinks in the cabin because they look most kind of aesthetically pleasing and they work the best. What's funny, quick word on that, is that I overheard, not on this flight, but on a flight last week, a passenger had obviously witnessed that we had started the flight and it was pink mood lighting all over the aircraft. And then it transitioned to a more orangey glow to match the sunset outside. And then it gradually became sunset inside the cabin. And then it was a blue tone while people were sleeping. And I heard him say to the crew, wow, how many shades of lighting are there? It's been quite impressive. And I was thinking, little does this gentleman know, on something like an A350, there are 17 million shades available to airlines as to what they can have wash over their mood lighting. So it's an insanely big number.
What they can have,
what they
but
can
not necessarily
have,
what they choose.
Correct. And not necessarily what is loaded on to the flight attendant panel and then into the aircraft on every A350. So
I didn't tell you this, but when I flew QR's A350 with my brother back in March, they did that thing where they turned the lights off immediately after, like, I guess they served everyone the meal pretty much at the same time after takeoff. Then they turned all the lights off, asked people to close their window shades, and everyone was like watching movies or awake. No one was sleeping. So I asked the crew, like, is there any way for you to just put on like some sort of mood lighting? And he's like, no, because if I do, the only option is to have like quite bright lights that will disturb people if they're sleeping. I'm like, huh? So then he went to...
That's not the case.
It was, we know what they're trying to do when they turn the lights off. But I was like, come on, like just leave a little glow of purple or a little glow of something because it looks so nice as well. But
and that's why, you know, that's why these aircraft are fitted with these systems. It's literally so that you have non-intrusive lighting.
Yeah.
It's so that you are able to feel that you're in a nice cozy dark cabin and start to drift off. But meanwhile, if you did actually look up, you would notice that there is this lovely mood lighting glow that is not in any way, shape or form kind of pushing down onto you as overhead lights. So yeah, but as you know, you just said, we know why this happens. We know some crew have this wonderful idea of everyone just falling asleep at the same time, no matter what time of day it is.
It's true. And it's funny how airlines can be so particular about lighting as well, because I remember when I did the Emirates A350 inaugural and the crew was freaking out. They're like, no pictures, the wrong lighting is up, we need the welcome light. And I'm like, what's wrong? And they were telling everyone, no photos yet, wait.
Lighting is everything. That extends way beyond aviation, right? Everyone knows that. So I would argue that's why. I love it when I think lighting can be so powerful. By the way, I love how we've just now descended into this long conversation on lighting, but lighting can be so powerful. In a single aisle aircraft, I love it when a short haul aircraft, like a 320 or a 321, has excellent mood lighting to just make that awful short haul tight economy cabin feel anything a little bit better. And I think BA can be very good at using the blue mood lighting all across the cabin. That paired with the music, the famous BA music, that's you know, it can be a bit distracting with the fact that in the back you've got like 29 inches of seat pitch.
Yeah, but I mean, credit where credit is due to the likes of Delta and United, because they really work the mood lighting on their 30-year-old narrow bodies, which they've, you know, upgraded with better lighting and stuff. But that's something I love about the Airspace cabin, for example, that you have this thing on the ceiling. I don't know what you want to call it, but in the center, that really cool pattern. And then
you mean like the kind of the facets pattern, the kind of crisscross, the it reminds me of when Etihad had the facets of Abu Dhabi pattern in the 2017 campaign with Nicole Kidman and all of that. Before I find out about your travels and I ask you, what is it you sent me a few days ago with every airline now seemingly just deciding to declare themselves as the world's best?
Because now it's United, right?
So previously it was Delta. Oh, we have the world. No, this is the world's best at elevating the world's best airline. Not elevating to become the world's best airline. They said they're elevating the world's best airline.
Yeah.
Who is the world's best airline, according to Delta themselves. And we act a little short of that on social media, went viral. Now United rock up, United enter the chat, and you send me something where United refer to themselves as the world's best airline. And so in the spirit of all these US carriers doing exactly, you know, whatever they please, we don't need to discuss why. We're just going to make the declaration now. Hello, everyone. Happy Wednesday. You're listening to the world's best podcast. I'm Alex. Yeah. That's Dan.
With the world's best hosts and the world's best audio.
The world's best host.
Oh, okay. And the world's best podcast owner.
Podcast owner?
I don't
owner?
Know what to call it.
Who's the podcast
owner? How
about owner?
Podcast boss? Let's make that me and then make you, we'll call you the host. The world's best host is fine.
World's best host. Okay, I'll take that. You can be the world's best guest host.
No, the world's best podcast that? Manager and consistent host.
You don't I was about to come for you about managing. You do manage quite a lot. I don't even want to get near that territory because it might trigger you, and then suddenly I might be left to, God forbid, edit this episode. Figure out how to get it online and then before you know it, there's no episode for anyone.
Watch it. No, but I think the point is that I always believe in not using superlatives necessarily, there's no reason to just keep telling people whether you are the best or not. I mean, in the case of the US carriers, they definitely are not, but just do your thing and do it well and people will notice. And I think people really appreciate something that's underrated, something that's underappreciated, that they just think deserves more recognition. But if you're giving yourself that recognition, I don't think you're fooling anyone. You're making people view you through a more critical lens than you have to.
Of course, like with anything, if you declare this as, you know, if I come over to you now with an avocado toast and say, this is categorically the world's best avocado toast, from where you may have previously not have passed any judgment on it, naturally, you then would and tell me the reasons why you think it wasn't. So definitely anyone that's doing that in aviation is setting themselves up for that kind of criticism. That's for sure. Let me segue directly into what a week you, Dan, have had. I have so many questions I want to hear in detail. I want the uncensored, unfiltered take on everything you got up, maybe not everything, but most things that you got up to over the last week, because you were invited, like I was, but I was unable to attend because it did fall over Greek Easter and also just Easter in general, not just Greek Easter, but this, this year Greek Easter was aligned with wider Easter. And so I had, you know, for Greeks, Easter is quite a big deal. And so I had all of the family and everything. So anyway, I couldn't attend with you, but you were invited to Jeddah, not Riyadh, where in Jeddah you would be the first, you would go on to become, and you didn't know this at the time, to be the first in the world to see Riyadh Air's new business class cabins. The Saudi startup airline that is a project of the PIF, the Sovereign Wealth Fund in Saudi Arabia, the public investment fund, that is supposed to commence operations later this year. We'll see how they go about that with all the supply chain issues with Boeing and Airbus and so on. So you accept the invitation. We both know you're going to be, you know, the first, and I want to hear every single detail. What were you thinking before? How did you get to Jeddah, not Riyadh? Why Jeddah, not Riyadh, and everything?
Okay, we'll obviously do this as a bit of a conversation, but let me just intro by saying that it is funny that it was in Jeddah and not Riyadh. And I think what I could surmise from this weekend is that presumably there was someone at Riyadh Air who happens to be a massive F1 fan, someone pretty high up. And originally, from what everyone told me, the event was supposed to be in Riyadh because the brand is Riyadh, as we know. But I suspect this person was like, they saw the opportunity to get free tickets to the Grand Prix in Jeddah this weekend by moving the event to Jeddah. And as a consequence, everything ended up being moved at the last minute to accommodate this and sort of have a crossover opportunity. And the cool thing is that what they ended up doing, which I'll get to more in a second, but basically they occupied this huge sail-shaped building in the Jeddah Marina, which is right by the racetrack, and they turned it purple. In fact, the whole Jeddah Marina was lit up purple, which I don't know if it always is, but it was perfect for Riyadh Air. So in the background of a lot of wider shots of the race, you end up having this big Riyadh Air branded building, and you could even see it's pretty cool. So
I was watching, I had the Grand Prix on Sunday, and yeah, everything was awash with purple.
Yeah, it's, I don't know how intentional that was and how much influence they had, but anyway, we pulled up to Jeddah on, I guess it was Friday night, and the irony here is that Oscar and I have been to Saudi before, 3 years ago in 2022. Then we were very nervous because obviously Saudi, especially back then, was not really used to tourists. Not a lot of people we knew had visited, so it was sort of uncharted territory. But this time, I don't know if this is, you know, something spectacular to people who have been to Saudi a lot of times, of course, but we were not nervous, not worried at the least. We pulled up there like we would pull up to any other country in the Gulf.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, I think that when you think about how we grew up with our image of what Saudi Arabia was and the things you heard from Saudi Arabia in the Western news back then versus the image you get now pulling up to Saudi, those just don't compute. They don't match, because I think that Saudi has changed so much and so fast. And they're the first country in the entire Gulf, for example, to have a literal section on their official tourism website in the Q&A that says, are LGBTQ plus travelers welcome in Saudi Arabia? Yes, they are welcome here. There's no other country in the region that does that. And when you think about Saudi being the one to state this, that's, you know, a big deal. So we pull
out, trying to make sure that they are crystal clear in that when they say that Saudi Arabia is open for all, they want to make sure that they, that that's the message that they are being crystal clear about. And as you say, Saudi's very, very quick unwinding of everything that made it super conservative has happened over such a short space of time that still not many people that you will meet outside of the Middle East have actually made that visit to Saudi Arabia yet. Not because Saudi Arabia isn't necessarily ready for them, but more because it's all happened in such a short period of time that they either, you know, feel that, you know, yeah, but is it actually different yet? Or is there actually going to be stuff to do, all this? So I feel like that time bit is still needed for the wider rest of the world to get the message.
Yeah.
But what they have achieved in this short space of time is unbelievable in terms of being now a host for major global sporting events and the boxing and the, you know, that their F1 is now huge. They host that, they're involved with the golf, and that they have, as in the golf as in the sport, not as in the golf as in the
Gulf
area
of
the
America,
Middle East.
You mean?
Yeah, not the Gulf of
it's
America.
It's not called the Gulf of America.
But, well, they are kind of involved with that as well. But yeah, they, you know, that their reach is now far and wide in their investments globally. And so, as I say, they're kind of open for business, and the acceleration that has happened is just tremendous. And I guess that's why even you said you've been to Saudi Arabia many times, but perhaps arriving, you know, in this part of 2025, you know that you're coming to a country, you're going to a country rather, that is absolutely on board with this idea of the concept of tourists.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And the Saudi Arabia is clearly very conscious of its perception at the moment. They're trying to attract 100 million tourists by 2030, which is obviously a little too ambitious given that there's no country in the world that receives that many tourists, but they have lofty goals. Mm. And obviously they want to appear welcoming and not scare people off, which it's ironic because I'm a US citizen, but right now I feel very nervous even by the thought of going to the US, let alone by bringing Oscar, who is not a US citizen. So the fact that I would feel nervous about that, about the possibility of getting detained there, about the possibility of them not upholding their laws or rights or my rights, it's just crazy that I feel, you know, safer going to Saudi Arabia
and
in 2025.
Let's come to that after this discussion on what you've been up to in Jeddah, because we have many questions about the whole, you know, we didn't get to it last week about the fact people are arriving to the border, even US citizens themselves, and are being told to hand over and unlock their phones and what your rights are there and everything. So we'll come to that.
Yes.
So you fly to Jeddah, what?
So we pull up to immigration. This is where the fun starts, because I go up to my agent. It's all normal. It's all fine. Oscar is right next to me. And the guy goes, "Oh my God, you're the YouTuber." And Oscar goes, "Huh?" He's like, "I watched all your videos when you came here 3 years ago. Those were amazing. Welcome back." And then he goes, how is your friend?" He's not referring to me. He's referring to the 16-year-old Saudi guy who invited us into his house in northern Saudi Arabia.
That's your video that went viral. Yeah. All of Saudi were using it. Even I received that video 20 times. People that did not know that I knew you guys were, because it went viral in the Gulf. People added Arabic subtitles so that the Arab world had a better understanding of this amazing embrace that you had from, like, you know, this hospitality was so authentic and lovely, and it went viral, that video.
Yeah, and he ended up being awarded by the Ministry of Tourism for exceptional Saudi hospitality. He's now famous on TikTok. So it was it was so funny that was our welcome. We get in our car, we head out on some of the most dangerous roads we have ever encountered in the world. The Saudis need maybe slightly stricter driving laws, but we made it to our hotel in one piece.
Understatement.
Yeah. And the next morning we were chilling before heading to the reveal of this seat. And they had already told me that I might be the first if I came a little bit earlier than everyone else to see the seat. So I pull up on one side of the Jeddah.
At sunrise.
No. This is at sunset. I pull up at at one edge of the marina, and everything is crazy because this is literally right where the F1 is taking place. It's Saturday, so it's qualifying. So even getting in there is crazy complicated. And then our driver was limited in where he could drop us off. So he dropped us off at one place. And I was like, surely this is not it. Because first of all, there was nothing Riyadh Air where he dropped us off. But then as I looked across the bay in the marina, I saw this massive Riyadh Air branded building. And I was like, I think that's it. So we walk in the 35 degree heat around the whole marina. We get there. We see some of the lovely people that you and I know at Riyadh Air. And we're welcomed in. And it's pretty impressive because apparently they set everything up in, you know, a matter of a day, if not less. And they had these huge displays with their different cabin crew uniforms and the whole history of Riyadh Air, which of course isn't too extensive yet, but it went a lot into detail about the history and the future. And then they had this really cool exhibition inside this beautiful building with basically sketches. I don't know if they were real or not because it was almost too cool to be real. But sketches of how they developed the seat. So basically different angles of the seat and then different comments. Like, can we add this here? Is it possible to put a lamp here? Is it possible to do this? And different notes they had as they were developing it and different fabrics they were trying that we could feel and all this stuff, which I think was such a cool way of presenting it before you get to go see the seat itself. So you get this context. And then we exit these big sliding doors. And at first I was so confused because I thought I was looking at a screen because it looked like something that was too perfect. But it was actually the sunset. The sun was just setting over the Red Sea outside. And it looked so unreal. The light was like a mix of orange and green somehow. And I literally didn't think I had actually walked outside until I heard that the ocean was splashing up toward this back set. And then they had this little dome, I would say a Riyadh Air branded dome that I enter and there is the cabin. And it's literally only me with these four seats. So two are the business elite seats, which will basically, interestingly, be sold as a separate cabin. So unlike what other airlines are doing with their business plus, where you can pay extra to assign a certain seat, this will be a different level of business class where you'll get, they told me, different food, different bedding, different amenities. Everything will be upgraded. So in a sense, this is, I think it's interesting because it's kind of like saying this is our first class, but we won't charge first class prices for it. It's
and just to have gone.
I was just going to say that the seat itself is pretty much what you would expect from a first class seat on a 787. Given that the 787 is a narrow plane, there's limited space, so it's kind of what you'd get on British Airways in first class, for example. But here, obviously, they're calling
talking
it business elite.
You're talking about the business elite.
The first row.
So these are four seats. Yeah, the first row. So for the visuals, right, for everyone listening now, if you imagine the cabin. So on the 787-9, which is the aircraft that Riyadh Air is expecting to launch operations with, they're going to have a business class, a premium economy, and an economy. The business class will have the lie-flat beds in a 1-2-1 configuration. Premium economy will be 2-3-2. With a generous seat pitch of 38 inches. And then economy will have a 333 layout, standard for a 787, with a 31-inch pitch. Again, pretty standard. 17-inch of width. Not so, that's quite tight, but again, classic for a 787 economy, really. The seats that Dan was just referring to, where he was mentioning how it's kind of like a first-class seat, is that if you imagine the business class cabin, in business class, you will have the first row, which is business elite, and business elite is only four seats, and these are basically bigger version seats of the rest of the cabin. The rest of the cabin which has 24 seats. These are the business class seats, also in a 1-2-1 configuration, adopting a way more kind of standard seat approach for business class. It's a seat in the market from Safran. It's known as the Unity seat. So Riyadh Air's business class seat is already in service at other airlines globally. Of course, airlines customize, they make bespoke adjustments and so on. But this is a catalog seat. And the Unity you'll find, for example, on Japan Airlines on the A350-1000. It's also the seat, the new seat that Qantas is going to take. It flies currently with Air India on the A350.
Is it currently flying? I think that's the seat that Air India is planning to introduce on their own A350s. But right now they have the ex-Aeroflot seat, right? I'm going to just double check that. While Alex looks this up, I'll just explain that the front row seats, they may be based on the Safran Unity, but it is truly, saying that seat is different from the rest of the seats is an understatement, because you don't have any restriction by your legs. Your feet don't go into any sort of cubby. It just feels incredibly spacious, and you have the option, if you're in the middle, of having a double bed, which you will not have in the other rows, basically, behind that. So,
and I thought with this announcement, Dan, there was, when you saw the cabin and they did this big reveal globally as well, they sent out all the images, and the images and the visuals were great, the renderings of what they want the cabin to look like. There was so much attention. Almost all the footage and photos focused on these first four seats, the first row. So there's only four seats. The business elite seats took up most of the campaign. I was more interested, of course, in what the cabin was in that. The majority of people, if you're flying in business, for example, in Riyadh Air, will be in the 24 business seats, which, as you say, very different experience. But you were there. You were there at the actual seat itself that has been customized for Riyadh Air. What was your take on, let's start, so we've heard about the elite seats, those four. Mm-hmm. What was your take on the actual business class seat, the 24 seats that will make up the business cabin?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's a little bit hard to tell when you're sitting in a mock-up like that what it will feel like on the plane, because when you're if you're outside of a plane and you have the option of sitting in any type of regular seat, I think by comparison an airplane seat might feel quite small, because ultimately I know that you, like me, you go to a factory tour, for example, at Airbus or Boeing, and you see an airplane fuselage and you go, no way they fit this many seats in this tiny space, right? Once they pull out the seats, it's shocking how small and narrow the cabins actually are, no?
Yeah, we always look at, don't we, the cross-section of cabins, and we think, how do they fit these big suites and these big... I couldn't understand how Japan Airlines first class on the A350-1000 is a seat that fits into an A350 rather than, you know, an A380, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what I mean to say by that is that a 787 especially is a narrow aircraft, and you can tell that these are not the most spacious seats. We've had people a lot of people on my social media are comparing this to Q Suite and going, wow, it looks like a 2025 version of Q Suite, or it reminds me of Q Suite 2.0, that kind of thing. But remember that the Q Suite, especially Q Suite 2.0, is made for the 777X, which is 10 seats across. And I think, you know, you could even cram in an 11 seats across if that's your thing as a low cost airline. But a 787 fits 9 seats across with 17 inches of width, which makes a huge difference. Which is very tight. Yeah. Not to mention that the aircraft also isn't that long, and the airline is trying to fit in ultimately 28 seats between the first two sets of doors. So what the width, I actually didn't find to be that much of a problem. All you notice is that there's not really room for any storage bins at your side. You have
this
the
is
surface
in business class.
In business, you have the surface on, like in most business class seats, a surface to store stuff on your side. But then what you will notice at least in this mock-up, is that the distance to the screen in front of you and the actual seat pitch is not that big at all, because I feel like a lot of the space is occupied by trying to make a longer bed and allowing the seats to feel a bit wider versus giving you a lot of space in front of you. So I imagine if the pitch remains the same as it was on the mock-up, we might hear some people commenting about the seat not feeling the most spacious. But again, Riyadh Air is working within the constraints of the 787. And you and I were discussing this. Mm-hmm. I was also discussing it with some people at the event. Which other 787 business class seat is there that feels more spacious than this? I've thought of one now, which would be the Apex Suite, which is available on Oman Air, on Korean Air.
Oh, that's very true. The Apex Suite is great for a Dreamliner. Yes. Because that also, I mean, I think you, so again, I don't want to focus too much on the business elite, because that's just focusing on one row of four seats, right? And so let's talk about the fact that Riyadh Air said they were going to introduce, quote, a revolutionary business class. Now, of course, the Safran Unity seat, a pretty standard, you know, off-the-shelf catalog seat, it's a good seat. But a Safran Unity seat in the confinement of a 787 tight narrow cabin, which a 787 is a narrow cabin anyway for a wide body, that in my experience is probably going to feel much tighter and less room to kind of move left and right than most other seat products. More to do with the fact that you're in a 787 and that they can't really put in the most generous spacious seat config. My first reaction trying this seat in its mock-up for another airline, but I know that this other airline are taking it in an almost identical configuration and setup and customization, etc., the CMF, they're taking it in an almost identical way in which Riyadh Air are taking it. My verdict was that the screen felt super close to me, so you sitting felt in that the same seat. And then, and that also the kind of moving left and right struggled a bit. Now, you, first person in the world to actually be at Riyadh Air's seat, published that video, and the comment that I picked up on immediately is you said, in the normal business class seats, you did feel that the screen was very close. And I thought, okay, we're aligned there, because I remember feeling that when I tried this in Hamburg a couple of weeks ago.
Exactly. So obviously, let's just go back to the Apex Suite for a second. Unfortunately, no airline will ever be installing this seat in business class again, because although it's a fantastic seat, it was made as a dense first class product, not as a business class product. And it takes up so much real estate compared to any other business class seat. So really, the two options that Riyadh Air would be looking at if for an off-the-shelf seat that are, let's say, world-class, would either be a reverse herringbone, similar to what Qatar Airways has on their 787-9, which they call the business suite, or a staggered configuration like we have with the Safran Unity. And, you know, just for context here, Oman Air, which has the Apex Suites on its 787-9, which is the aircraft Riyadh Air will be using, they fit 24 Apex Suites in the spaces between door 1 and 2. Meanwhile, Riyadh Air will fit 28 seats with this seat. And keep in mind that this is with a business elite. Qatar Airways on their 787-9 without, let's say, a special front row, so the front row doesn't take up extra space, they have 30 seats between door 1 and door 2. So that just shows you the sacrifice that Oman Air is making by using a seat like this is too much for it to make sense economically, unfortunately.
That's very true. And that's exactly the kind of conversation that happens at these airlines when they are deciding on their seats. It's not simply how they look or how comfortable they are, but does it make, you know, financial sense in that when you take up this space, if there's no passenger in that space, you're not getting any earnings from that area whatsoever.
Yeah. Overall, though, I will say that besides the seat structure itself, the seat finishes and the attention to detail, this is where you notice, you know, similar to Qatar Airways, a true attention to detail where there's just these luxurious little touches like the door to the side panel where you'll find usually your headphones, a water bottle, that kind of thing. That has these little cutouts where there's just some fabric over it, creating this nice backlit lighting effect that sort of lights through that door. Or, of course, I think the thing most people notice is the swoopy white seat backs that resemble Arabian tents that you would have traditionally in the desert or in those types of places. So there are these very nice touches that I think elevate the seat a lot. There's mood lighting inside the seat, behind the seat itself, in the seat structure that at the event was lit up purple, but I imagine they'll have different lighting settings there as well. To give you even that type of feeling inside your seat is very special. And then they are promising a lot for the soft product. So this is something, you know, you and I will be looking out for. I expect a lot, and I expect good things from the soft product. So that is the state of Riyadh Air right now. They're still hoping to launch flights this year. I think everything hinges on Boeing being able to get things together, and they're not in the best situation now with the tariffs, but Riyadh Air is definitely hoping to be able to launch this product as soon as possible, and hopefully, they said, at least install it on install the first aircraft fully outfitted with one of their cabins very soon.
The premium economy and the economy seats were not there at the event display.
Because they wanted to draw all the attention to business. Although I will say, for anyone who's flown Emirates premium economy, Riyadh Air has chosen the exact same seat that Emirates uses, except they've also added these nice privacy shields along the side, which Emirates does not have. So it's basically the same seat bones, just the addition of that. And they also explained that, as you might have noticed, their seats are fabric, not leather. I appreciate a fabric seat. And they said they agree, because when it comes to sleeping, especially, let's say, in premium economy or an economy where you don't have a mattress, that, you know, sleeping on leather can feel a bit strange. And for business class, another exciting thing they told me is that they are planning to have the thickest business class mattress in the sky. So hopefully they stick to that, because that, I think, would be, you know, much appreciated.
Arabic Twitter was kind of having a big conversation about comparing what Riyadh Air are going to be offering compared with other airlines in the Middle East. And they were focusing on economy. And a lot of them were not happy. A lot of the users were not happy with the dimensions of the economy class seat, in that it's a 31-inch pitch and a width of 17 inches. They were comparing it to Saudia, the national airline, but also to the neighboring countries, Emirates and Qatar and Etihad. And Riyadh Air were coming in at the bottom in their measurements there as the tightest economy class seat. Now, they were taking that. Of course, it's a 787, and they're perhaps were comparing to airlines that either don't have the 787, or they were comparing it to airlines that are having a more generous pitch on aircraft that are not the 787. So it wasn't always the most accurate comparison. However, the bit that I thought was worth mentioning is that all of the Saudis that were engaging with the tweets were sharing clips of the CEO, Tony Douglas, explaining how everything was going to be revolutionary, like nobody had ever seen before. It was going to be something truly unique. He was asked about economy class, and he said that it was an absolute game-changing economy class experience that nobody else had. And then they were kind of, you know, writing question marks and saying, like, is it nobody else has it because it's the tightest in the industry or is that, you know, so again, it's that, you know, the way in which such rhetoric can be harmful at the end of the day to your brand, because if you are going to promise but not deliver something revolutionary, because let's be real, how do you revolutionize economy without sacrificing, you know, the financial burden that would follow that? You have to be real in some sense. And economy can be made comfortable in many different ways. But if you are going to the market with a 30, 31 inch seat pitch and a 17 inch seat width, of which, you know, that is a tight seat by any metric, think about what people are going to think when they realize that's for an airline that said, so, you know, they were so-called revolutionary when it came to all cabin classes. Yeah. So that's that. The other thing I heard is that, and don't get me wrong, this is a beautifully designed cabin in color palette, in material choices, and all of that. The some commentary I read, focusing more on the premium style, was that people expected more because of the way it had been hyped up as something unique. So I think there are a lot of people that were quite sure that Riyadh Air would not be taking an off-the-shelf product. I have known for quite some time that Riyadh Air were taking the Safran Unity seat. It is an excellent seat. As I said, it is fantastic. It's flying and has and it will soon be flying on so many different airlines. It flies on Japan Airlines A350. I've done that, and that was great. But again, is that rhetoric? Let's be real. The airline is taking something catalog, and I understand that in the race to get this airline set up, they haven't had the ability to start from scratch and patent and design this whole new seat for themselves, like apparently some expected. As I was just reading through all of the verdicts from across the industry.
Yeah, I think maybe they took one look at Lufthansa Allegris and they thought, you know what, let's not make a custom product because we know how badly that can go. But yeah, I think both of us have sort of anticipated that there is a lot of big talk, because after all, this is the Gulf. We have airlines here constantly promising huge things, yet not necessarily delivering things as huge as we expect, especially in economy. But, you know, we had Emirates when they introduced their retrofit last year, right? When they said, we're once again upping the game when it comes to premium travel. And we're all like, okay, maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration. We know that the Middle East is a region where they exaggerate quite a bit. And this, I think, is no exception. But it all comes down to the soft product in economy at the end of the day. This is what we said last week, funnily enough, where even on the world's best airlines, in our opinions, the thing that sets an economy class experience apart isn't really the seat. It's the small, soft product touches, like getting an extra ice cream here, giving a nice set of toys to kids, giving perhaps more premium feeling meals and more choices for meals. All those types of things. One thing, though, you know, that would have been fun to see is the expansion of the air couch or air lounge kind of concept to the Middle East. Because right now we have this, of course, originating at Air New Zealand. They've had it for quite a while. But there are a few other airlines that offer it as well. We've spoken about it. Although Riyadh Air, you know, they chose not to do this, perhaps it doesn't make sense given that most of the flights they operate will be shorter. But to explain what it is basically...
Yeah, just in case anyone's unaware.
Yeah, Air New Zealand has this thing called the Sky Couch, where in certain rows of economy along the three seats by the windows, there's a leg rest that extends up. You have to pay extra for this, but it extends to create essentially a bed where from the back of your seat to the back of the seat in front of you, you now have a hard supported surface that they will put a mattress on. You'll get better bedding. So that, for example, it's most popular, I think, with couples, because then you only really pay the premium for one extra seat because you've already paid for two. And then you get to use the Sky Couch and have a lie-flat surface that's far more comfortable than spreading out on just any row of economy seats. So this concept, I think, works especially well for the likes of Air New Zealand because they operate such long flights where people are really willing to pay a bit extra for extra comfort. For an airline like Riyadh Air, although that would have been a very exciting thing to introduce, they, like other Middle Eastern airlines, are located in a great location, making flights to the majority of the world's population a lot shorter, 6 to 7 hours to reach. I forget what percentage it is. You might know this, of the world's population.
80% of the, yeah. 80% of the world's population.
Exactly. So in that case, you know, maybe people are not willing to pay that premium for a sky couch.
Maybe. Let's move on to the fact that you then attended the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. You were at the Saudi F1. That was your first F1. I was probably more excited for you to attend the F1 than the fact that you were going to see the Riyadh Air Seat.
I know.
Because I knew you hadn't been to an F1 before, and you were going in Paddock, at the Paddock Club, which is the highest end of the hospitality offerings for F1. If you're going to go to the F1 in Paddock, you may as well do it at some, you know, at one of the kind of bigger, more opulent Grand Prix, such as the one in Saudi. I was really excited for you. I said to you, you need to keep it cool. I said, there's going to be celebs there, you know, don't freak out, Dan, because I saw how you freaked out, you know, over nobody in Paris.
Oh my God. They were not nobody, okay?
They were. And yeah, so how was that? How was your F1 experience, your first Formula One?
Amazing. Honestly, I think that even if I was not an F1 fan whatsoever and I knew nothing about F1, I would have...
Which you are not.
Well, I do know... So I know a bit. I've watched several seasons of Drive to Survive. So I would say I'm like a light casual fan in the sense of I know the names of the drivers... I know the teams, but I don't really follow it. So going there, obviously we knew we were going, so we studied up a lot. We watched the whole latest season of Drive to Survive. We were reading all about this 2025 season and what's happened so far. Mm. So we were quite prepared going there, but nothing prepares you for how cool it actually is to be there. And of course, the highlight was getting to do a pit walk, where you get to actually walk past the garages and see the cars up close, see everyone working on them, preparing
for the
race.
That's my favorite part as well. That's really cool.
It's just so cool. And the cherry on top was that a few Nonstop Dan viewers were working at Mercedes F1 team and invited us to go check out the car up close. It was just
amazing.
Unreal. So cool. And of course I got
knew you would love it, and you were super like casual about it when we first both received the invitations, and I was like, Dan, it's 3 days at the F1. You were like, yeah, you know, I'm just thinking about how I get to Jeddah and things like that. Yeah, I was like, Dan, it's 3 days at the F1, you're going.
Yeah. And I'm so happy I ended up going, because it was amazing. And of course, these guys I got to speak to at Mercedes, we had a lot of aviation chat, because that's what you do. Mm. And this is a whole world I haven't really thought about before. I realize the drivers, the team leaders need to get to and from Jeddah, for example. But there are literally thousands of people working at each F1, from caterers, even, you know, the section of the Paddock Club that we were in. There must have been hundreds of waiters and chefs and all sorts of things just in there. So to then think all of these people need their own hotel rooms, they need a seat on a plane to and from this city. No wonder it's impossible to find a hotel room. It's impossible to find flights on a weekend like this. Mm-hmm. And even so, these guys are...
That's without factoring in all of the spectators.
Exactly. So these guys at Mercedes, for example, they're based in London. But British Airways, of course, is sold out, because the highest priority, I guess, people will take the direct flight. But there's only so many business class seats on that plane. Then all the rest, because there's hundreds of people, need to somehow get back to London on another airline. So Mercedes apparently usually books British Airways. So what these guys were doing, poor things, was taking the 3 a.m. flight the night after the race, when they had been working the whole day out in the almost 40 degree heat. 3 a.m. flight to Doha on Qatar, nice for them, to then have to connect to British Airways from Doha to London. So
wow, it's a beast. Moving around F1 weekend to weekend is a beast. And you just commented on getting, you know, moving around the people and everyone of each team, and then the people that work for F1 itself, and then the engineers and the ground staff, if you like, and those that literally make F1 happen. They all go from F1 to F1 as it moves around the world. Plus all of the equipment, of the cargo that is necessary for F1. It is astronomical. It is a massive aviation movement almost weekly throughout the year. It is such a mammoth task. Fun fact, the Qatar Grand Prix, the Qatar F1, happened a week after the F1 in Vegas. And the night that the race finished in Vegas, a British Airways A350, two of them, operated as F1 charters nonstop from Las Vegas to Doha to bring the F1 from Vegas to Doha for the following weekend. And so they position on the same night, carrying all the equipment and many of the top team.
Yeah.
And I don't mean the race teams, but rather the F1 staff, top tier, to Doha. And then the teams have their different ways of positioning in and positioning back, and they've got contracts with different airlines and so on. So yeah, it's a mammoth task.
Yeah. What a cash cow that F1 is for British Airways. They're really, there's so
well,
many,
not just for BA,
for sure, but
for so many airlines. But if you've got a home team,
so many teams are based in the UK, and British Airways is their go-to airline.
Yeah.
That's massive. And you know, it's funny when you think about, sometimes you don't reflect on why is British Airways sending a 787-10 instead of the normal 787-8 on a route. This happens all the time, especially with BA having the ability to switch, you know, the capacity between their three different types of 787s. But
yeah,
in this case, for example, we saw them upgauge to a 787-10 to offer a few more seats, a bit more capacity to all the people that would be flying back to the UK. So it's not only the F1, of course, it's all types of different events going on all over the world all the time. A lot of people I met at Riyadh Air are going to the Arabian travel market in Dubai, for example, which is next week. So that's another time when airlines will see quite an influx in demand from people traveling from all over the world to attend a conference. Hotels will be more expensive. And, you know, sometimes when you're traveling, you're on the other end of that where you have no idea what's going on. But all you know is that the hotels on the dates you happen to be somewhere are really freaking expensive and you don't know why, but you realize there must be something going on because things are crazy.
Something's up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Overall, well, just
good. You're an F1 fan now.
I am. And I have to root for Mercedes because Mercedes roots for nonstop dance. So there you go.
How that's how it works, is it?
Is that? Yeah, that's how it works. Of course, have a lot of Q&A, but there's one thing we have to discuss because we've been, you know, putting this off several episodes in a row, which is travel to the US is getting increasingly concerning. We are getting more and more stories of people having their phones searched, confiscated on arrival. And these stories are getting everywhere. So sometime the news has to break from the industry that demand is softening significantly, surely.
There are a few airlines, for example, I was just reading last night, Ben Smith, Air France, KLM, said that economy bookings to the US have softened. He said that is the reality. But they're not seeing anything too long-term yet to say that this is time to start sounding the alarm. Tariffs are, of course, causing a big problem. That's the tariff side of things. But also, as you say, all these anecdotes of people arriving to the border. So basically, people, including American citizens, can arrive to the CBP agents at the port of entry, whether it's, you know, an airport. But in this scenario, we'll discuss airports, of course, keeping with air travel. And they can be asked at random, ma'am, we need to see your phone, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They can not only ask to see it, but they can plug it into a computer and take all the information that you have off the phone. All the photos, all the notes, all the texts, all the emails, everything. And they're completely in their right to do that.
Now, isn't that utterly terrifying?
Yeah.
Not because of that, oh, you know, for the overwhelming majority of us,
yeah,
you know, not everyone is going to have things on their phone that are of interest to the US state, right? But that's besides the point. The whole reason we don't live in a society where this exists is because there are certain freedoms that we should have as individuals everywhere globally, let alone in the so-called land of the free.
Yeah.
I mean, how does this... I keep seeing these anecdotes. I keep seeing these travel stories and I think this is a nightmare. And now I actually know somebody, a lady called Mina, who is an American citizen, arrived to the board and they said, we need your phone. She was like, nope. They said, but if you see here and here and here, we have a right for your phone. So if you are now going to decline handing over your phone, then we need to take you to a side room and we start a whole process of the fact that you disobey the order of the Custom Borders and Protection agent. Right. Now what? Like, she was on the phone to her lawyer, all this. What a mess.
Yeah.
This is terrifying.
It really is. And to think that you have to censor yourself. I've seen all these TikToks from different immigration lawyers, people giving advice for what you should do to have a risk-free entry into the US. So they say, wipe your phone, or better yet, get a burner phone to clear immigration, encrypt any information that shouldn't be shared, be prepared to lose your phone, your laptop, your iPad. It's like,
oh my God.
Okay, well then I don't want to go. I can go anywhere else. I can go to Canada. I can go to any other country in the world. Why should any tourist choose to travel to a country that's treating visitors like this? It makes no sense. Look at so many countries that are doing their best to attract visitors that want to be appealing and welcoming toward tourists because they realize that it has a huge positive economic impact on their country. And meanwhile, you have an administration that is supposedly pro-economy and economic growth that is doing everything they can to scare investors away, to scare tourists away, because people don't want to have a government go through everything on their phone, because people have private stuff on their private devices. Go figure.
I mean, it's insane. The US this week have revoked the visas, the student visas of more than 1,200 students, seemingly for no reason. On the diplomatic side, the Colombian president has had his US visa revoked.
No
the,
way.
Yeah,
I missed it, that.
I mean, I feel this is just getting out of control, not okay because of the Colombian president, but for me, I think it's just more how custom officers are now able to search your phone, as you said, your laptop, your iPad, and how you can protect yourself. I don't like the tips about how to protect yourself. I mean, the fact that the New York Times is running a piece, you know, tips for travelers entering the US, you know, turn off your phone and perhaps suggest that you don't have one on you and all this, it's insane. Immigration lawyers are appearing on Australian nightly news with advice for Australians who are facing this whole new world of US border intrusions. The immigration lawyers that appeared on the primetime networks in Australia had suggested if there was one piece of advice, just one, it was what you had said. It was taking a burner phone, a disposable phone with you and claiming that's the only phone you have and printing out bank statements in a printed form, not giving access to your online banking and then handing over your phone. All of this is crazy. There are reports about how now in the queues to enter the United States, quote, anxiety is palpable because of the way in which US border agents are now able to conduct their research by deep diving into a humble visitor's phone. You know, a woman was caught up with this with her kids. She's taking them to Disney. It was the trip of a lifetime. She's been saving up to go to Disneyland, Florida. And for some reason, she's the target of an agent who demanded to see all of her devices. She didn't know her rights. She was scared. She just got off of a 7-hour flight.
Yeah.
I don't like any of this. I don't think anybody does. And if any of you have had scenarios like this, get in touch with us. We want to hear how it went down. If any of you are concerned, take the advice we just, Dan just highlighted, but also feel free to write into us via the Instagram as well, On Air with Dan and Alex.
Yeah, good.
That's the
point.
Shared Instagram now that we now have to just double check things with us,
yeah.
Because nobody is exempt from this, even US citizens.
Precisely. So if for any reason you need to go to the US, or like me, you have family and you can't choose to vacation somewhere else, this is the advice I'm giving all my American living abroad friends. Choose to fly via Dublin, or if you live further away, Abu Dhabi, so that you can clear US immigration and customs outside the US. You can do US pre-clearance in Abu Dhabi and Dublin. Why is that better? Because you're not going to be detained in some prison cell for 10 days or 2 weeks, like we have just story after story coming out about. Because worst case scenario, you get rejected and you stay in Ireland or Abu Dhabi. Worse things have happened. So if and when we eventually have to go to the US, because I imagine we're going to be going to the US in the next 2 years before the, fingers crossed, midterms take place, we will 100% be flying via Dublin to get there. And that's what I recommend other people do, just to have the peace of mind that you won't be detained in some sketchy place. Because then once you fly through Dublin, you land as a domestic passenger. You don't need to stand in line to immigration. You don't need to clear customs. So the odds of something going wrong are significantly lower. And also, if you want to refuse, for example, to give over your phone or give anything, then again, you get to stay in Ireland. You don't get in trouble.
And remember that for visa holders, or for those on the visa waiver program, like the Brits that get access through the ESTA program, any travelers with that kind of visa waiver or a visa visiting the United States are at direct risk of being denied entry and deported back to the point of origin if, for example, you refuse to unlock your device.
Yeah.
That is the America that we have today.
Exactly. And the crazy thing, the heartbreaking thing about this is that if you have been denied entry at any point to the US, which a lot of people are being now, you will never be eligible for a visa or for an ESTA ever again. You'll have to apply for a regular visa. Good luck getting a regular tourist visa after you've been deported from the country. And this will harm your visa applications to every other country you want to go to in the future, because every country on their visa application asks, have you ever been deported or denied entry from another country? So it's just a risk that I personally would not take if I didn't have family there, if I didn't have any very legitimate reason to go to the US. And even with family there, I'm considering every way I can to avoid actually entering the US. At least over the coming 2 years.
It's also worth recapping that back in 2014, the Supreme Court in the US had ruled that a warrantless search of someone's cell phone, which is what this is, violated in the US Constitution, the Fourth Amendment. But there was an exception to this, which is these searches that happen at the border, the ones that we're discussing now. So the same court found that any searches that happen at the border are, quote, reasonable simply because they occur at the border, meaning that the CBP, Border Patrol, don't need the warrant to look through a traveler's belongings. You're not actually in the US yet, technically. You haven't entered. And so everything is kind of on the table. And that's the worry. Last year, in 2024, and I've got a note on this, in 2024, less than 0.01% was the figure of passengers that had arrived internationally and had their phones, computers, or any other devices searched. But we know the figure for 2025 is going to be different. The percentage is going to be different because there are documented now anecdotes everywhere. As I say, I now know somebody personally, lady, her name is Mina, and she is a US citizen, and she was in this standoff at the border for a long time because they demanded to see her devices, and she is involved slightly with politics, so I'm not sure if that's why, but yeah, we're in unusual territory here, and God, I hope this weirdness is just a wave that passes, because no one should be arriving to so-called the land of the free and have their stomach turning that they may have to hand over everything. And if they don't, then face the consequences of that.
100%. So with that, we're going to try to do some Q&A for you guys as much as we can. Let's dive right into it. So Vishal asks us, what are our favorite Fifth Freedom flights? And what do we think are successful Fifth Freedom routes? Which routes would be successful as Fifth Freedom if they launched?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Well, I'm going to ask, I'll answer the second one first. The ones that I think would work, literally, there's endless opportunity. I think of the African continent and I want them to liberalize. I want them to embrace Fifth Freedom. I want growth for the sector across the continent of Africa, and Fifth Freedom is the way there. Mm. So that would be great. The ones that I would love, for example, Singapore Airlines and all of these wonderful airlines to just set up shop at Heathrow and say, we're going to now do Fifth Freedom to the US so that I don't have to fly a US carrier. I would love that.
Yeah.
I would love Singapore Airlines to say, hey, Malaga, you look super lucrative. Let's do a one-stop via Terminal 2 Heathrow. That would be great. But I'm dreaming. So Fifth Freedom would be great. My favorite ones that exist, New York to Milan, New York to Athens. That's on Emirates. That's there are examples of pretty cool Fifth Freedoms.
Exactly. Barcelona to Mexico City, another Emirates one.
Barcelona, Mexico City, that's a good one. Oh, JFK Frankfurt, yeah. Singapore Airlines.
Yeah, that's another one. So the key is it needs to be a good airline. Otherwise, we don't need your Fifth Freedoms, guys. It has a little bit of KLM from Singapore to Bali doesn't excite anyone, you know, besides the low prices.
No. No, even though I can ignore.
Yeah,
it's... because it's KLM. I'd rather, you know, go find a better deal somewhere else.
Precisely. I think that Fifth Freedom to work, gosh, it needs to be the middle city needs to be a city that doesn't have a very strong loyal local aviation market where people, for example, aren't fiercely loyal to the home airline. It's even better if it's a city that doesn't have a massive home airline. So, you know, that or the destination city is not one like that. That's why I think certain routes, like we have Dubai to London on Royal Brunei, which I think is fascinating and not a route I imagine is very competitive for Royal Brunei when you have airlines, British Airways on the British side and Emirates on the UAE side, that both have fiercely loyal customers. So who is flying Royal Brunei exclusively between London and Dubai? I really have no idea. But yeah, hopefully we'll get some Fifth Freedoms from Riyadh Air. How about that?
I'm just seeing, I've just landed in my inbox. Can I say this? Because it's under embargo. When does the embargo lift? Yes, I can. By the time you hear it, it's fine. Actually, I'm not going to, just in case this episode goes out before the embargo.
Okay.
It's all right. It was just root news. That's fine. Go on.
So
continue.
So Sartak, I'm sorry. I'm not sure how to pronounce this name, but he says, I was in the exit row on an Air France A350 from Toronto to Paris, and the seatbelt is a thick layer of rubber. I've never seen anything like this. What could it have been? I think the explanation is the seat has a built-in airbag in those cases when the seatbelt is very thick, right?
Yes, that's correct. That's probably what you had there. And typically, well, for example, it's more common in business class to get a seat with an airbag, and that's to protect you from the monuments of the seat that you are sitting within. Sometimes you get it in economy class as well, depending on where you're sitting. For example, if it's the window in an exit row, because you have the way that the door kind of comes out in front of you, is to protect you in that scenario.
Yeah,
that's probably what that was.
Exactly. Here we have a question from Harry asking, should Qatar Airways acquire more single-aisle aircraft to serve less demand destinations like Belfast, Dalaman, Innsbruck, etc.? Well, that's the plan, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, so the A321 Neos are on their way beginning next year with a Q-suite class and an economy class. And I'm wondering if they've announced that or if I've just announced it for them.
Yeah.
but no, everyone knows there is going to be a business class and everyone knows there's going to be an economy. And so that's what the airline will have. But the 321 Neo, like it has for many airlines, will be able to unlock those secondary cities, specifically the secondary European cities. And who knows, maybe Dan will get non-stop to Gothenburg once again.
Everyone
makes a mistake. So he's hoping that it wasn't a mistake and that it was just the pandemic that ended it prematurely. And so let's see. Here we go. I'll commit here on the podcast, all right?
Wow.
If the airline... relaunches non-stop flights to Gothenburg.
Oh my gosh.
Then I commit to coming to your humble hometown.
Yes. Okay. I'm so excited. Now you have to, you know, be my advocate and make it happen because we need it. I mean, look at what Etihad is doing. At first, it seemed like they would have such a cool development of their route map with the A321LR. Now, they're adding frequencies to Phuket, to Bangkok, to Paris, all on the A321LR. We're like, this is not what we meant. They're flying 777s and 787s on those routes as well. It's, tried to make it seem cool at first, and now they're just using it to increase frequencies like we've complained about before.
True.
Peter asks, what do we think about Air India's rebranding efforts and their new safety video? Will they succeed?
I think it's a decent rebranding. I think that there are elements of the design I don't like. That's just a personal preference. There are elements of the design that I do like. And design is subjective and people will agree and disagree. So I think it's a difficult question to answer because it's very, very personal. But I think on the whole, they've done a good job.
Yeah, I don't love the safety video. I think it's a bit too chaotic. Air India's rebranding, I think on paper, looks great. I've been to their lounge in Bangalore Terminal 2 quite recently, which is actually very impressive and very beautiful. But they have a lot of work to do before there will be a truly competitive airline. So final question for today here from Chris. This cracks me up. Do your friends and family also text about to take off the moment they pull back from the gate? Like, do they not, like, do they think the runway's right next to their gate? This is so true. Does this.
If I send the about to take off text message, we've just lined up on the runway.
No, if you send about to take off, your wheels have already left the ground. Like,
yeah, that's true. Sometimes I'm texting you and you know that I'm already airborne and it's just, like, if there's no Wi-Fi, feet. It just cuts out. That's true.
This cracks me up because obviously you and I are always tracking friends and loved ones' flights. If the flight has anything to do with us or even if a loved one is flying at all, I'm tracking it. And then I see them text, okay, taking off, talk to you later. And I'm like, you literally just started pushing back. You won't be taking off for another 30 minutes, but okay. typical. All right.
That's a good one.
That's it, guys. Cool. That's what we have time for today. So on that note, we will catch you all next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax?
Sorry. Did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.